What is this? Kindergarten? Nursery school? Nope. It is Sparkwood and 21, the No Ship Network podcast on the Showtime television series Twin Peaks. Welcome back. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em. So we are here discussing Twin Peaks, The Return, Part 13, which is also titled, What Story Is That, Charlie? And this is written by David Lynch and Mark Frost and directed by David Lynch. And this episode opens at Lucky 7 Insurance Company with Anthony Sinclair looking through the blinds of his office. And he is startled by the celebrating human train of the Mitchum brothers, Candy, Sandy, Mandy, and Dougie. Come on, ride this train and ride it. Woo, woo.
That's exactly what I thought when I saw this. I just started singing that song and all. Mandy, Sandy, and Candy want to ride that train.
Come on, ride the train.
All you kids from the 90s will remember that song.
Oh, yeah.
So Anthony's jaw is now on the floor. He takes a dive behind his desk. The train winds its way into Bushnell's office. So when they're in the office, first thing Bushnell says is, Dougie, you may want to call your wife. And Dougie says, wife. And this makes everybody erupt in laughter. And they have come bearing gifts for Bushnell, which are Monte Cristo's number two, which are cigars, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
A pair of cufflinks and a car, which is a convertible BMW, which Dougie has also been gifted with. So what I thought was interesting is there's a number two related to all of these in some way, like the Monte Cristo's being number two, cufflinks being a pair, and then there's been two cars given out.
Nice.
And I think this is Candy's favorite part of her job, is giving gifts or giving things to people, because, you know, last time we saw her, she was really happy to serve up that pie to Dougie, and here she is really getting into giving this car to Bushnell.
She could barely contain herself when she opened the keys up. Your brand new car!
Right. I mean, and then monogram diamond cufflinks. I mean, it's quite the series of gifts.
And, you know, like, I was trying to picture myself, like, how I would act in Bushnell's situation. I'd be like, I can't accept this stuff. No way. You know, this is too much. But he's just like, oh, guys, you shouldn't have. This is so nice. I mean, he's winning and winning because now he's got customers for life. We already know that he made money off of the money that he had to pay out to them. So it's just like, it's win, 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 win all around.
Yeah,
so
he's funny in love because, with Dougie. Like,
yeah, everybody loves Dougie, except Duncan Todd and Mr. C.
And Steve, you had pointed out the music that they had playing while they were doing the train. It sounded like a slot machine.
It did. Mm-hmm. If you've ever been in a casino, the electronic beeping sounds, it almost sounds like an annoying video game, because that's what slot machines are, annoying video games that you put money into. But the two times that I've been to a casino, I can still hear that noise in my head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like an 8-bit version, kind of like an old school Nintendo version of slot machines.
Yeah,
you know, because they've come a long way since then. But yeah, it definitely had that spinning wheel, almost like do 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 noise.
So it seems like if you allow Dougie into your life, he's like the Buddha belly. He brings good things like luck,
right?
If Duncan Todd just took a different tact with Dougie, maybe things would be resolved with him too.
Right.
Maybe he wouldn't necessarily have to annihilate him.
Yeah, if he could just go over to Team Dougie and everything would be okay, and then he could get a little buffer zone between him and Mr. C and not have to have him in his life anymore. Mm-hmm. Although, if Mr. C comes after you like he comes after Ray, you're kind of just fucked, I guess.
Yeah, you're just fucked.
Yeah, once they get near each other, if he's still in Dougie form, it'll be like a weird cloud Highlander thing going on.
There can only be one.
So Anthony has now crawled deeper under his desk. The happy train exits. Anthony is now on the horn with Duncan Todd. Duncan Todd gives Anthony one day to remedy the Dougie situation. And I liked how Anthony was like, he said, but you said two before.
It's the way he does it. Tom Sizemore is just so, sincere. He's just so groveling. And, you know, I think it's great that an actor like him, who always plays all these tough guy gangster type roles, you know, to where it's like he doesn't even blink when he looks at you for minutes at a time, and then he shoots you and kills you. Like he's playing this guy who's having an emotional breakdown, and he's doing it well.
Yeah, it's almost like him and the actor that plays Duncan Todd should have flipped positions. You know what I mean? Because you don't see him playing gangster in any of his other parts. It's almost like they're like, let's just mix this up a little bit and kind of put them on opposite ends.
It's a great acting opportunity for both of them.
Right.
True.
Exactly.
True.
And pray he doesn't alter the deal again.
I was thinking the same thing.
So after hanging up, Duncan Todd calls in Roger. So I'm thinking that he's preparing a backup plan because he can see that this is going south.
Oh, yeah.
with Anthony. So that means we're going to see more arise towards Dougie, some more threats arise towards Dougie from the angle of Duncan Todd and those two detectives.
Yeah, well, the backup plan's on its way. They're already going through Utah. You know, they're on their way down to Vegas.
Yeah, but is that because of Duncan Todd?
No, but that's I bet Mr. C's contacted him and let him know that they're on their way.
Yeah. They might be on their way to deal with Duncan Todd because Mr. C is anticipating Duncan Todd possibly not fulfilling his particular.
It could be the combo. I wouldn't put it past Mr. C. He's scary enough.
So you're saying that they would have to take out Duncan Todd if he doesn't succeed in taking out Dougie, but they've already kind of set the hounds on him, so it's going to happen no matter what.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Mr. C gave Duncan Todd an ultimatum about this.
Yeah.
Now, do you think everybody else that's tried to take Dougie out has run into obstacles, right? Do you think that maybe if Duncan Todd tries to take out Dougie again in another way, or maybe himself, that he falls on the Dougie side, gets a special back massage, and then wants to help take out Mr. C?
Anything is possible, because a couple episodes ago, we would have not thought the Mitchum brothers were riding that train.
Right.
You know,
so it'll be interesting to see how Vegas plays out for sure.
Sonny Jim's gym set is delivered along with a convertible BMW. Janie E is beside herself with tearful joy.
Yeah, that Beamer is sweet. Sweet.
Later that night, the gym set is fully erected and bedecked with flashing lights. Sonny Jim is running and jumping on the trampoline. A spotlight is also splashing across. The spotlight's very strange.
Yeah, it's kind of creepy, to be honest with you.
There's been spotlights used in Lynch's work before. Mm-hmm. Also, with him running around and jumping on that trampoline reminds me of the little boy from Fire Walk With Me that wore the mask that was in the parking lot after Leland saw Laura and Ronette on the bed after he decided not to hook up with Teresa and her two friends.
Okay.
And this little boy was running around jumping, and a song called Black Dog Runs at Night was playing on the soundtrack at that time. So what if Sonny Jim's a lodge host? Like, what if he's hosting, or what if he's hosting the Giant and Janie E is hosting Dido or Dido, the woman that was up there? I don't know.
There's something. Like that a lot.
Maybe they're there to protect and guide Dougie.
I'm totally down with that. I think it's fantastic.
But I don't think, I think other people have already put that forth. It's not a new idea, but this is the first time I really felt like I saw something that linked Sonny Jim to that sort of mythology.
Yeah.
I could see Sonny Jim being that way, but I haven't seen anything in Janie E's behavior that
I agree with that.
Especially with her, you know, having this newfound attraction to him a couple of episodes ago and stuff like that. That doesn't seem like behavior Dido would be sanctioned to participate in, much less maybe desired to do.
Yeah.
I don't know, but definitely Sonny Jim. The whole scene is really surreal without the arc of blinking lights and the flashlight and everything else being lit up. And then the parents are just kind of staring at him, you know, like, and it's kind of funny because with all of the diversions that kids have nowadays, all the video games that they can play, the TV that they can watch, all their electronic toys that they have at their disposal, that this kid is going to find such simplistic enjoyment in a jungle gym.
Dude, which, that was the coolest jungle gym ever, though.
Yeah. I would like to think that most kids would. I know I would at that age, but I didn't have, you know, nearly those kinds of distractions that the kids have now. So, true. You know, they're inside playing Minecraft on, you know, huge screen TVs and stuff like that, and while they're talking to their friends on headphones, and they've got their cell phone over here. So I don't know, but I think it's awesome that Sonny Jim was able to play on his new gym set.
Now, watching this kind of jogged something in me, because I watched it a few times. I've been working on the Twin Peaks pieces, you know, and, you know, I can be a bit of a Debbie Downer because I always feel like somebody's going to get it. So one of, I'm throwing this out there, what snaps Coop into place, because he's kind of, Dougie's kind of comfortable in this life that he's kind of like building around him, and everything is so good. His wife is like super happy. His son is super happy that they get killed, and that's what snaps Coop into Coop.
That would, that would be hard to watch to see. Because I think we've all grown attached to Janie E and Sonny Jim to a certain extent.
I agree.
Even if just as extensions of Dougie, but we care about them. We don't want to see anything bad happen to them. So that would be pretty
not
horrible,
at all. But if you think you've got to kind of untie Coop from this family for him to be able to go do the things that he needs to do.
Yeah.
You know, how do you cut him from the cord, you know? Oh, I just don't know how they're going to tie that up. Or they don't have to, and he just leaves.
Or that he brings them with him. Mm. She has to drive him to Twin Peaks, and it's in Twin Peaks that he becomes Agent Cooper again. Okay. Through whatever else it's going to happen. So then we get a scene with her in the double R or something like that, something funny like that.
That's a lot more pleasant than my route, so I'm good with that.
I don't know if either of them will really take place, but I don't know. We're getting close. We're getting close, and all these characters are still in play. I think a lot of us thought that these characters would be here for an episode or two, and then we would move on to different things, and it would go the way we thought it would go in our minds. And it has not done so, and it doesn't look like it's doing so anytime soon. So nothing is off the table.
As Janie E. and Dougie are watching Sonny Jim play on his gym set, Janie E. again is expressing her joy, and she describes this as a seventh heaven, and Dougie repeats seven heaven. And then she tells Dougie that she loves him so much, and he mouths the word so much. He doesn't actually vocalize that.
Yeah, I noticed that. He just says it silently.
To me, that tells me that this is showing that things are about to unravel between them.
I agree with that. I mean, something's got to give.
Eventually, we've been saying that. I feel like we've been saying these kind of declarative things for probably the last seven or eight episodes. Like, okay, this is where it starts. It, you know, and then we kind of start going back towards Twin Peaks, and it's just like I'm starting to quickly get to the point where I feel like all of that Dale Cooper Twin Peak action is going to actually happen in the 2-hour finale, or the last two episodes put together, however you want to put it. I think that's where it's all going to happen. I'm getting, because we have four more dates of Twin Peaks, and one of those is going to be a 2-hour thing. So we could easily see the next three be just like this one, and then everything just escalates really fast into the 2-hour finale.
All right, so now we're in Western Montana, a new location. Mr. C pulls into a large warehouse, and Ray and two thugs watch on a large screen as he pulls in. Those guys are Muddy and Renzo being the boss. And when Ray sees this, he drops a lot of fucks about the arrival of Mr. C, and he explains that he tried to kill him, and Ray wants to trap him in the garage and deal with him there. However, Renzo wants to have fun with him first.
Now, when Mr. C first gets out of that truck, he does something with his jaw, and he reminds me a lot of Bruce Campbell right there, just for a split second. The way he's looking around at everything, and he just kind of like, his tongue is moving in his mouth, and his jaw moves a certain way, and just for that frame, he looked like Bruce.
How big was that TV they were watching? That's like the biggest security TV ever.
This is my favorite scene in the whole episode.
Him getting out of the car?
No, just the whole thing in Montana.
Oh, yeah. It's pretty cool.
Mr. C, he steals the show here. He steals the show. This is just, you know, I figured it. If I've got Kyle MacLachlan on screen, I'm cool. It doesn't have to be Dougie. It doesn't have to be Dale Cooper. It doesn't have to be Mr. C. But if it's any of them and they're doing their thing, then it's worth it.
So Mr. C is instructed to ride in the elevator. And now facing the thugs, the terms are negotiated involving arm wrestling, who's the boss, and Ray. Mr. C does not want to be the boss. He wants Ray. And he has this great line that Steve opened our podcast with is, what is this, kindergarten, nursery school?
Well, even right when he said it, I was thinking the same thing, like, arm wrestling? What the fuck?
I did too. I even said it out loud. I was like, are you serious?
Yeah, what kind of gang is this?
I agree with you, Mr. C.
Which is something I never thought I would say either. You know, I was like, okay, he's got a point.
You know you're in bad company when there's a whole cast of like extras from Sons of Anarchy and you're rooting for Mr. C.
Right?
You know, like, hey, man, this is just a shitty place to be.
So they start to head into the area where they're going to commence the arm wrestling. And as they're walking in, Renzo punches Mr. C in the back of the neck. So apparently he was a little upset by that nursery comment earlier. And I was wondering, is this even necessary? You know, was it just because he was offended by that comment? Or was this like some sort of cheating where you punch like, because I know like at some point on your spine, your arms are innervated by that particular part of your spine. Well, so is he trying to weaken his arms a little bit?
No, I think it's also a tactic to get into his head, you know, because any kind of sport, which arm wrestling is considered a sport, you get into your opponent's head like this guy's pretty much bullying him by punching him in the back of the head and getting to his head like That's for the comment. Wait till I get you in here for the arm wrestling. You know, it's a pretty standard tactic. A lot of teams will do that. You know, kind of like the Braves doing the tomahawk chop and the noise, you know, is to get the other person pumped up and to intimidate the other team. So I think he was just kind of poking. Unfortunately, he's poking the real bear to get him riled up. Didn't realize that it was he's going to make a pay for that.
Right. And so that behavior is so animalistic. It's like mm-hmm. that alpha male type stuff. And,
well, yeah.
And then the way that, you know, they could easily transition from one boss to the next because of might.
Because of arm wrestling. I mean,
I know. And it's, you know, the more that I actually rewatched 8 episodes over the weekend. I didn't achieve the 12 like I had set out to mm-hmm. do. It's a lot. To watch. But there's a lot of subtext about violence in this mm-hmm. show. And, you know, with the first time we saw Sarah Palmer, she was watching that nature documentary.
Oh, yeah, the lions.
Yeah. And so we're convinced that Bob is involved with her. And, you know, Bob has also been kind of put forth as that sort of rage and animal lust mm-hmm. that exists within human nature as well. So I think going back and watching Sarah Palmer with her watching that, and also with that reflecting in the mirror behind her, like we saw Bob for the first time, that to me is a very strong confirmation that Bob is heavily involved with Sarah Palmer right now. And also that there's a lot to be discussed about violence in general and how that is a guiding theme for this story.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
You bring up a good point about how they change leadership so quickly, and it is like a pack of wild animals who would do the same thing. Once another alpha male kills the leader of the pack, then just by doing that, they have the loyalty. You know, all the loyalty goes to that animal now, right. Whether it's mm-hmm. a wolf or dog or however, whatever animals run in packs. I'm not really sure. But because they just do it, you know, right away. It's like, what do you want to do, boss?
But they're very much technologically speaking advanced.
Oh yeah, with their security cameras and cell phones and.
Well, there was really nothing else in the place, so they spent all their money on those TVs, on that big ass TV and the cameras.
Which there was talk of the farm. Do you think this is the farm? Because it does not look like a farm.
No, I don't think it's the farm. I just think that they. I don't know. I just don't think it's it.
Is it a thug farm?
It could be. I mean, it actually could be because there's, I mean, the shot that you get right before he pulls in to the compound is, you can see that there's like trees and stuff out there. It doesn't look like farmland in the natural sense, but I mean, that whole part of the country, I mean, you farm potatoes and stuff like that. So, I don't think it's a potato farm, but it could be in the sense of like, you know, when they say like a farm team or a farm mm-hmm. league or whatever in sports, to bring in another sports analogy, where this is where you keep all your people that you're going to need to go do your dastardly deeds. It's like a bullpen for bad guys.
Wow, yeah, kind of okay. Like the minor league, kind of like, yeah, where yeah. you first go to gain your chops, to gain your reputation.
That's interesting. I like that mm-hmm. idea.
So that could be what the farm refers to.
So now they're at the cushioned tabletop that's set up for just for this, and they get into starting positions, and it commences. And you could tell by the look on Mr. C's face that he's going through emotions here. Oh, he brings him back to starting position and then allows him to put his arm back down and brings him back into starting position again, saying starting positions are more comfortable. Starts talking about how what hurts his arm, but this hurts my arm even more. Oh, and Ray is progressively getting stressed as he's watching this. He should have started running immediately, is my opinion on this.
Or just pull trigger regardless. Like, oops, I shot him. My bad.
And so the men are having to hold Ray back. And mm-hmm. at one point, Mr. C even just turns his attention towards Ray and keeps his eyes on him for a few seconds and was still able to control what was happening on the table.
Yeah.
In the end, he ends up slamming Renzo's arm, breaking it, I think.
Yes.
Then punches him in the face, turning it into a sucking orifice, which then later spits blood when he hits the floor. It's pretty disgusting. I think his eye got...
Yeah, he caved his face in.
Yeah, he broke like the bridge of his nose and his like forehead at the same mm-hmm. time. It looked like because it was just indented.
Oh, yeah. Now, because of the super strength, because to be able to beat somebody like that, do you think... I mean, Bob's still inside of him, right? I mean, that would be the explanation of him being super strong.
I don't think so. I think it's because he's a doppelganger. I mean, unless Bob just didn't employ it when he was Leland, but Leland didn't have super strength.
That's true. That's true. It's crazy how.
But Nadine did.
Yeah. I mean, fuck. It's crazy how to beat somebody like that in arm wrestling would be a feat, even if you were that much stronger than a guy. Because he pretty much flipped it on the guy, like, okay, you're going to punch me in the head and mess with me. What he did to that guy just broke him down, demoralized him throughout the fight. Like, here, I'm going to hold you a half inch above the table. It was one of the coolest arm wrestling matches I think I've ever watched on TV or a movie, you know, because it was pretty menacing. And then the way that he ends it, I mean, it was shocking.
I haven't seen many arm wrestling matches. I would have to say for sure this is the coolest one I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I would have never have thought, like, if I was writing an arm wrestling match, like, I think I'm going to have them just bring it back to starting position. And I'm going to intimidate him at starting position.
Right.
Okay, so he defeats Renzo. He's dead. And upon command, the late Renzo's men give up their cell phones, which, while also, I think the guy Muddy states that there is no reception there anyway, but Mr. C doesn't need reception.
No, fucker. Just give me the phones.
Yeah, I'm going to use your phones as burner phones, basically, is what I'm going to do.
Here's another thing I kind of thought about. If Mr. C didn't have a phone, who was Diane texting? See, she might not be as nefarious as we think if he didn't have phones.
No, he had a phone when he left.
When he left? Damn it.
Chantal and Hutch, he probably, depending on when the time frame that was anyway, because time is definitely sketchy in this show. This episode proves it. In fact, we didn't talk about that. The one thing we need to say about Dougie's scene is that he's been gone overnight.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because he had pie with the Mitchum brothers and now he's gone overnight and now they show up at Bushnell's with the gifts and everything. But do you remember when we saw Dougie last episode? What was he doing?
Playing throw.
Yes, he was playing throw.
That's true. I don't know.
Maybe. I feel, you know, yeah, you can use that as a way to say, look, if we're going to try to fit everything into a linear timeline, that particular thing doesn't fit because we were just told that Dougie didn't come home that night. So he was obviously after the pie party with the Mitchum brothers, they kept partying all night long. And then the next time anybody sees them is when they're coming in on the train.
Yeah.
Right. So, but I also feel like that scene in last episode or last part was with the throw with Sonny Jim was really just to let us know that, like, okay, we're giving you literally 5 seconds of Kyle MacLachlan because he hasn't not been in any episode yet. So we have to squeeze him in here somewhere because he wasn't in any other part of the episode as Dougie or Mr. C. And I know that sounds kind of like a weak sauce explanation for it, but it feels like it was just put in there too. But how does that square up with the time? You know,
it doesn't.
Like, so, but as always with the timeline stuff, until an explanation comes out, the jury's always out for me because I don't know that is exactly what it means. Because I feel like there should be, and there usually is, even with Lynch, better signs. You know, somebody talked about this in feedback. I forgot who it was, but they were talking about how even Lynch lets you know that there's something different is here. You know, this isn't the normal like flow of time.
So do you think that Mr. C sends a text then busts the phone like every time? So how many texts did Diane get in the last one? Two, right? The coordinates and then L.A.?
She sent the coordinates. She got the Las Vegas.
Las Vegas, yes. LA, Las Vegas.
So that's why he needs more phones because he's doing that. He's probably squashing each phone after he sends a text.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Either way, it's just something that came up.
They gave him a phone when he got out of jail.
Mm-hmm.
He got a phone. And then
and
he threw
it out the window.
Mm-hmm. And then when they got to the farm, they smashed another one.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just something that I thought of whenever he was getting like the plethora of flip phones.
Okay, so Mr. C, he asks for some privacy for him and Ray. I wonder if he's going to let that slide that he didn't actually get true privacy.
Well, I don't know if it's like 100% privacy because he knows about the TV, right? So I think it's more of y'all get out of the room just so I can do what I need to do without y'all saying stupid shit like there's no reception or boss.
Yeah.
I told y'all I don't want to be your boss. It's like the amount of contempt he has for these guys. Now, granted, that's his demeanor to everybody, but it seemed a little extra to the goons. So I don't think he'll do anything about the Because if he wanted to, he could have made it distort like in the prison and cause noise so they couldn't hear. So, you know what I mean?
True.
So he's like, just get out of the fucking room and give me some space. You're bothering me, you know?
Yeah, it probably served him anyway to have them looking at him and witnessing what he was doing.
Especially with his boy in the house.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was a surprise.
Right? It was like,
So Mr. C shoots Ray in the leg. We see that this guy who reminds me of Pollux Troy from Face Off is standing in the back of the room, and he asks Mr. C if he needs any money. No, Mr. C doesn't. And so he goes down where the others went up. So
that must be his office where he counts the money.
I think we'll see more of him.
Pretty cool. They have their own accountant, though.
Right.
You know, maybe he's a lawyer, too, to keep it all squared.
It would make sense. I mean, why not have him do everything? He looked like he would be in charge of all that.
Yeah, it's just like Mr. C just got an army, where Dougie just got the Mitchum brothers and all their resources, and now Mr. C's gathering his as well.
Nice.
Right?
The board is set. The pieces are moving.
And he's got the smoke people, the woodsmen.
The woodsmen.
So Ray confesses that it was Jeffries who hired him to take out Mr. C. He said Jeffries set up the prison release and that Mr. C has something inside of him that Jeffries wants. Mr. C asks if Jeffries ever mentioned Major Briggs. Ray says no. And then Ray asks if he can pull something out of his pocket, and he pulls out the owl cave ring. He was given this by a man who was dressed as a prison guard, and he was instructed by Jeffries to put it on Mr. C after killing him. Mr. C demands for Ray to tell him the coordinates, and we come back to the men, the thugs, and Richard Horn is now among them, and he is drawn towards the screen, towards Mr. C. He works his way through the crowd to get closer.
I think a lot of people were hoping that he would get up close to the screen and be like, Daddy? Which I'm still not sold on that whole idea completely, so I'm glad nothing like that happened.
Papa?
I think he was in awe of that guy, because I think it made him think of Red as a, you know, low-rent hump, like Leo Johnson kind of thing.
Yeah, but at the same time, there was some disgust also in his face, like contempt. Like when he saw him, I felt like there was a little contempt, like deadbeat dad type look, you know, like, ugh, son of a bitch.
I saw fear. I thought, because his, you know, looked like he was swallowing, gulping.
Interesting.
I guess we all see what we bring to the table.
Right.
So Ray ends up giving Mr. C a piece of paper that has supposedly the coordinates on it.
Yeah.
Mr. C asks him, where is Philip Jeffries? And he says, the last I heard, he was at a place called the Dutchman's, but that's not a real place. And bam, Mr. C shoots him right in the head. And he says, I know what it is. What it is, not where it is, what it is.
Right.
I did look up Dutchman a little bit. We've gotten some really good feedback on this, and also the music that was playing behind Sunny Jim. So I'm just going to wait till feedback.
So I thought it was interesting that Ray was instructed to put the ring on Mr. C's body after he had killed him.
Yes.
Jeffrey's assuming that this killing could be accomplished in the first place, which seems to be a little bit naive now in hindsight. But when Mr. C has Ray put the ring on, then he kills him, the ring disappears, and then his body appears in the lodge independently of the ring.
Yeah.
Not at the same time, because the ring clinks down, and then Mike picks it up and puts it on the table. But you have his body, Ray's body, appearing in the lodge, bleeding out from his head wound.
Or something of him, because his body is actually still in the warehouse. And so then there's... Mm. But he's dead in the lodge, whereas Laura died with the ring on, and she lives in the lodge.
Yeah.
He could wake up from that.
Yeah, he could.
He could wake up from that, because a mortal wound in the real world isn't the same thing. You know, and when you get there, then it's like, okay.
Has that been established?
Well, just going by Laura's example, because how can she be dead in the real world but exist, you know, live there? So the rules are different somehow. Like, everything is twisted around.
It's too bad that jerk didn't shoot him when he shot him, put the ring on him right away before the woodsman showed up, you know? That might have just went ahead and sent Mr. C to the lodge.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Yeah, because he couldn't get close to him to do it because he was too scared of the woodsman, which, who wouldn't be? I wouldn't get near the... I mean, I would have been running way before he was, but...
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. I think the ring is going to remain one of those enigmas that doesn't ever get fully explained. And I think that's by design. And also because I don't know if Lynch isn't the sort of artist who starts off with the end in mind when it comes to things like that. I think he likes to keep those things open-ended so he can keep using them in new and different and cool ways. You know, so the ring can be this in one, you know, in the Fire Walk With Me section of the Twin Peaks saga, but then it can be this in this part, and then whatever Frost wants to do with it in the Secret History, it can perform there as well. Mm-hmm. So
just a tool.
Maybe it has something to do with that gold orb. Like, maybe that's why she's able to live and survive in the lodge after.
Oh, for sure. She's definitely got some extra juice to her.
Yeah, because when we saw Dougie, who had the ring on, who gets pulled into the lodge because of he had the ring on, he had this tiny little gold ball. So maybe he just didn't have enough to allow him to actually exist within that space.
Yeah.
Where Laura has just like this enormous amount. So maybe because she has achieved something in life that allowed her to exist within the lodge, where somebody like Ray, who's a POS.
He's just going to be dirt on the floor that needs to be cleaned up by the lodge, the lodge bots, you know.
Fertilizer for the tree with the ovary on it.
Yeah, the lodge Roombas are going to come out, you know, and take care of him and get him off of the floor because he's not going to turn into a gold nugget. He's not going to be able to live on like Laura. He's just a piece of crap.
Yeah, pretty sorry, much. Ray. Maybe they're going to make something out of him to where they use his body to come back and fight again, but not as himself. You know what I mean? Hmm. And that's why they want the body there.
We had said early on, I think probably like episode one, that it was possible that Mike was masquerading as Philip Jeffries or maybe as the billionaire.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, do you think he has a more active involvement in the terrestrial sphere than we've been led to believe up until this point?
I mean, it's definitely a possibility.
Because he's the one that puts that owl cave ring on the pedestal. I'm pretty sure that's his hand.
Yeah, for sure.
Huh. That adds a whole nother... If he's the one who's trying to orchestrate...
He's the one that gave Laura the ring to begin with.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if he's trying to... If you're saying Mike is trying to orchestrate getting Mr. C back into the lodge, and he's using the persona of Philip Jeffries to do that...
Because he's been hunting Bob this whole time.
That actually works for me. Mm-hmm. I could totally see that, even with the conversation in the hotel room after he killed Daria.
I've seen people say that it's too obvious, but it makes sense.
That's the genius. Yeah, that's the genius part is that it is obvious.
Yeah, because when you're watching Twin Peaks, you're always looking for something that's not obvious. You're always looking for something that's a little bit, that you feel is a little bit more clever than you, that's a couple of steps ahead. But sometimes that's good storytelling. You pull back and you keep the obvious thing obvious, and then it doesn't become obvious because of that fact until right at the end.
I mean, why establish that Mike has a beef with Bob and wants to subdue him in some way? Why would you establish that and not follow through with it? It seems like he's going to be pretty active towards his stated goal, which he was intent on when we were first introduced to his goal. Yeah.
And he's pretty active with keeping Dougie safe, so why not active going after Mr. C?
I guess we'll find out when we get to the Dutchman.
Yes.
Now we're with Detectives Fusco. And this scene is so crazy because, I mean, I think I've said like on two podcasts in a row, we just got to wait and see what happens to those fingerprints. Like, that's definitely going to amount to something.
it is a crazy scene because also what you hear in the background.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, dang, what the heck is going on back there?
She's pissing, apparently.
She's pissing. She's threatening to cut their nuts off. She's saying she's going to shit in their mouths. And she says, fuck you, Twinkies. That was the best part of this scene, actually, was the hearing that lady doing all that stuff and Phil back there trying to, like, subdue her.
But yes. It went pretty dark, though, because the screams that followed after that sounded like...
They were hurting her.
Something went.
Well, she was getting tased. They had to tase her to subdue her. Because it says sense. It like, use the taser. So, yeah, at this point, Detectives Fusco are like
terrible.
Useless.
Yeah.
I mean, they take the one bit of evidence that could have drawn Gordon Cole and company to Las Vegas to provide that link, and they have a dollar bet on a wastebasket throw. That's what that amounted to. All of this guy's connections with people in the deep state establishment and stuff like that just amount to zero. Mm-hmm. So you're like, okay, well, and then they really just provide kind of like a segue for Anthony Sinclair to come in and talk to his crooked cop.
Well, I'm hoping that whenever somebody looks into the prints, that it still has some kind of, like, the FBI will still get to hit, like, okay, somebody had a hit on these prints. So I'm hoping they still serve their purpose other than being morons, you know?
Right, they've actually established that being a possibility because the military had noticed that there was another hit on Major Briggs' prints.
That's right.
Which was, I think there had been 16 up to that point, so they get pinged.
Yeah, like a key log.
Provided that every different branch of the government is willing and capable of, you know, communicating and coordinating with each other, which isn't always the case. But, well, I guess we'll see.
Well,
I would think
the FBI would have something out on Coops, like keeping an eye on all that stuff, just like the way the Air Force were keeping out for Major Briggs. You know what I mean? So, like, certain people, certain wanted people, you know, or felons or missing FBI agents, there would be just a little extra keeping an eye out. You know what I mean? Let's knock on wood because Coop needs help.
Yeah, we need FBI there. Pronto. As Steve mentioned, we have Anthony coming in. He's seeking out a Detective Clark. Detective Clark is not at all happy to see Anthony. Anthony has come seeking advice on poisoning, and the recommended poison from Detective Clark is aconitine, which he can actually get for him himself. They make a plan to meet up, and as long as Anthony pays him $5,000 for this, Anthony leaves, and the other detective that's standing over across the way walks over to Detective Clark, and he wants to know what's up. Detective Clark tells him that he's cracking, and this detective, who I think is probably Detective Loomis, because there was two names that were on those Lucky 7 insurance claims that Dougie was looking at, and I don't recall Detective Clark being on there, but I remember there being a Detective Loomis.
Nice.
So I'm thinking that might be who this is. And he says he's going to go call Duncan Todd.
Loomis and Clark.
I didn't even think of that.
Right.
He's not afraid to tell Anthony what he thinks about him. No. Yeah.
And 5G's to help you stay safe is a bit steep. But hey, he paid it. So he knew he was going to get some money out of him at least.
We have a quick scene of Hutch and Chantal. They are entering the state of Utah. And this causes Chantal to talk about Mormons and what she has heard of them regarding their beverage choices and how they conduct themselves before marriage.
It was interesting, but if you notice the whole time, she's still eating Cheetos. Like, it's not going out of style. So
right.
And talk about what other people eat. Maybe look at yourself.
Like I said, I had gone back to rewatch, and the first time we see Chantal in her hotel room, there's like bags of snacks all over the floor, all over the chairs.
Wow, I didn't notice that. I'm going to have to go back and check. That's crazy. Loves her
junk
Cheetos.
Junk food junkie.
Ugh.
She's probably thinking it's a slippery slope. If they don't let me drink Coca-Cola, drink liquor, or have any coffee, maybe they'll try to take away my Cheetos. Right. So I could never be a Mormon.
Well, it kind of makes sense because they're always on the road. So if you're stopping at gas stations, snacks are really your only option. I'll give her that. I'll give her a way out to be a constant Cheeto eater. But still, you know, you could stop and get some decent food at a grocery store every now and then, too.
You crave what you eat, so.
I thought it was kind of a humorous scene because they're not actually bashing Mormonism, really. They're just kind of laying out what people in the Mormon faith do not do, right? And then, you know, Hutch is kind of like, yeah, but can't you marry, like, you know, have like 6 or 10 wives? And she's like, yeah, you would think there'd be more people jumping on the bandwagon to do that. And she goes, maybe it's because of all the drinks, though, that you can't have. And it's like that would be the reason. Like, oh, you know, polygamy's great, but I can't have soda with it, so now I'm fine.
It was entertaining, but at the same time, the main thing I was thinking was, okay, they're heading through Utah. They're going south. They've got to be on their way to Vegas, you know. I mean, I said it earlier, but it's scary thinking that they're going to be – it's something that Dougie Coop hasn't faced yet, you know.
Yeah, yeah. These two are professionals. Mm-hmm. Even though they don't seem like it when they're just having idle conversation, they are actually professionals.
Absolutely.
We have a quick scene where Janie drops Dougie off at work and she has hearts in her eyes. So she's more forgiving of him getting out without closing the door than she was the first time we saw her do that.
Yeah, she's not yelling at him, that's for sure. It's like, come on, sweetie.
Well, if she has to close the door on a sweet new BMW, it probably softens the blow of having to close the door every morning.
Yeah.
You know, opening and closing it.
She even had that new car grip on the steering wheel when she went back to drive it. It was like, ooh, nice.
Anthony watches Dougie at the front door. He runs into the door, which I've done more than once in my life. That hurts really badly.
Yeah, it echoed inside the inside of the office. It sounded painful. Wham!
And when he finally gets in by the kindness of somebody else who's coming in, Anthony approaches him and offers to buy him some coffee. So now at Simon's, Dougie is distracted by pie. So Anthony takes this opportunity to pour the poison into his coffee cup. When Dougie comes back, he's immediately attracted to the dandruff on Anthony's below Anthony's collar, which causes him to begin a feather light massage.
You know what I thought he was doing? I thought he was mimicking playing the piano, because a couple of nights before he was so taken with that piano player at Santino's, was it?
Yeah,
that they went to go eat, and that's what caught his attention, and we all thought Cooper was coming back, or at least I did. And you know, he's playing that mournful song on the piano. Mm-hmm. So it looked like he was playing like pretend piano notes on the back of his
kind of
his shoulders.
Well, why would that image of dandruff trigger that?
I have no earthly idea.
I just thought that he saw dandruff for the first time and was like, "What the hell? I'm gonna touch it," you know, and then was like lightly touching him with both hands to see it, you know, because it was probably falling off, you know, but it made me laugh because, like, you know, he's sitting there and Dougie's touching him. He's like, okay, you know, he just kind of falls apart and apologizes. I was like, that's genius. It's genius to have something as simple as Dougie just kind of touching him to trigger the guilt, or maybe just all the goodness that he has in him just makes people want to do the right thing.
Well, he's like this proverbial straw of a camel's back that finally breaks Anthony, which is hilarious because it was just like the lightest touch that did it.
Yeah.
But when I saw the dandruff, the only thing I could think of is that maybe it looked like the in-between space that he floated through looked like stars.
Ooh, that's a good point.
Like the speckled white on the dark background.
Yeah.
But why would he want to go start putting his fingers on it? Because maybe he's trying to get through to it, because he just had dealt with two barriers. He couldn't get in that door. He smacked right into one, and then he was dealing with pie on the other side of another barrier. So maybe he just assumed where he wanted to be was behind another barrier too. So he's trying to touch it with his fingers.
Yeah, I like that too.
But I like the barrier thing, though, aside from the dandruff thing.
Yeah.
Because we do need Cooper to get through that barrier. And I think with him constantly coming up against these barriers and failing is kind of a extroverted expression of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now at the double R. This is another time thing.
Becky calls
Shelley at work. Steven hasn't come home in two nights. It doesn't really seem like this is post-shootout. I mean, it just seems like it's such an understatement after you had the event that they had with her shooting through a door and Shelley riding on her car.
Yes, but this is something that a lot of people in poor relationships do, though, to where he's gone after she's been shooting the place up for a couple days and now she's worried and almost wants to forgive him. You know, it's kind of like a cycle, like almost being beaten and then going, well, you know, it's starting to in your head go, you know, to me, it's just her dealing, just her poor choice in men, and that this has probably happened before. So it's like, okay, well, something's happened to him. It couldn't possibly be that she's still cheating on me with this woman, you know? I mean, I see what you're saying. It is weird, but I've known people in relationships like this, and it seems like that's what they do, you know?
It just seems to me that this scene, which really has no place in the rest of this episode.
True.
Would have actually felt better to me personally if it was placed before the shootout, because you have a build up to the stress that Becky's feeling with Steven. And then and why Shelley would be like, oh, I'm leaving work right now, because there's been events that have been taking place before that have led up to that.
That's
moment.
A good point. That's a really good point. I looked at it differently, but that's a really good point on why it would seem fitting two episodes ago, you know?
I would have liked to have seen it then too. Uh-huh. It would have worked. The whole scene would have worked a lot better as a support to that. You know, have it happen before that and then have it be, you know, like in there. So if it is something that has to do with time being wonky, I don't know why. Because this, if you're going to mess with scenes that are not in their proper sequence time-wise, why do you pick a scene like this, though? That's all I'm wondering. So I'm not really contesting that it's like that. It could very well be that. But I'm just wondering why this scene what's the import of it? You know, I mean,
I don't know.
We're not going to know till the end of it, you know, obviously, for sure. but it just feels like you would be dealing with more important material story wise to kind of use that trick.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just my take.
So now we're back at Lucky Seven. Anthony's confessing to both Bushnell and Dougie about everything and sobbing. Bushnell asks Anthony if he's prepared to testify against Duncan Todd, and he also wants to bring down the two detectives. And by Anthony's reactions, it seems like he's more afraid of these detectives than Duncan Todd.
Hell yeah, because the detectives can flip it on him. You know, I mean, these detectives are tough, but they can put him in jail and not kill him. They can fuck him up in so many other ways, you know?
They can plant frame evidence. Him.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Use their connections, extort other people to, you know, plant evidence, whatever else.
Oh, yeah.
So now we're back at the Double R again, and finally we get to see Ed Hurley.
Woohoo!
Yeah. I like how they did it, too. It wasn't like a big reveal. He just kind of Bobby just walked by and he was talking to Norma and Ed happened to be there.
Yeah. Yeah, because he's asking if Shelley was there. Because Bobby's ordered dinner and then Ed wants him to sit down with him. So after some convincing, Bobby does sit there with Ed and Norma. And Ed asks Bobby, "What's new, deputy?" And Bobby says, "They found some stuff that his dad had left today."
Mm-hmm.
Stuff is very vague, but... Yeah. I think this is the same day that they found the capsule that had the information to Jackrabbit's palace. So this is out of time.
Possibly. I mean, it's definitely possible. I think he was vague because it's an ongoing investigation. He couldn't just say, well, let me tell you all about it just because of protocol, you know?
Yeah, I agree with that being the reason why he's vague. Mm-hmm. But is it the stuff, the capsule that he's talking about? Then if it is, this is out of time.
That's true. I mean, it's definitely, but wouldn't that weigh on Bobby's mind the most because it's his dad? You know, that would be the one case, like if my dad had passed away and that's the, you know, some stuff was left for me, that would be pressing on my mind more than just about anything. You know what I mean? Because the rest of his life seems to be a bit askew with his, I guess, ex-wife and his daughter going through these problems. It's probably the one thing Bobby's clinging on to. You know?
I think we're talking about two different things. I don't know. Because, like, what I'm trying to say is he said today we found it.
Does he say today?
He says today.
Oh, see, I missed that completely.
Yeah.
I didn't realize he said today we found some stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I apologize. I missed it. I watched it a few times and missed it completely.
Huh. Yeah, so
this... Well, it's got to be, right?
Unless stuff means something else. And they found more stuff. But I just don't think that's the case.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's kind of like Steve said, why would you put... Well, then again, why...
It's not going to make sense till we get to the end.
No, exactly. You know, I mean, we could sit here, go around in circles why they would do that with the scene. But it, you know, it's definitely... Or is it just a tactic to bring the Bookhouse boys in more involved in it by dropping that there? You know what I mean? I don't know.
I don't think they need to confuse us to bring the Bookhouse boys involved.
That's true. It's interesting. I honestly, I want to rewatch. Yeah, I mean, it'd be the only explanation unless he found something else. But don't you think they would have? We'd be privy to it, you know?
Yeah, I think they would have made a big deal about it if they found something else.
Yeah, absolutely.
Huh. When I first saw the scene, I thought he was talking about a different batch of stuff that was found altogether at his dad's house. Like his mom had, you know, the finding of the stuff in the chair was kind of like a catalyst, and maybe she thought like, well, what else is in the house? What else can I find? And maybe there was some paper somewhere, you know, up in the attic, or I don't know. It could be any of a number of things. And she found that stuff, and it's maybe not as important as what the, you know, the map was inside of the little metal capsule, but it was something that, you know, Bobby needed to see anyway. If it is out of time, I could see it being that day because he hasn't told, you know, Ed what it is yet. You know, you think he would have just been like, well, it's a map, but we're not really sure. Because it doesn't seem like official police business or anything like that. It could be anything or nothing. For all they know, it could be gibberish. They know it's not because they've got Hawk there and they, you know, he knows about Jackrabbit's palace and stuff like that. So they know it's not gibberish. But you think he would let Ed Hurley in anyway because he is a Bookhouse boy. And we've always, but maybe that's just a bias on our part because we've just assumed this whole time that he's going to be with them whenever they do their trek to go up there. But that's not necessarily the case. We don't know if that's going to happen or not. But once again, I always just fall back onto like, if you're going to do weird time stuff, I wish you'd do it with more like story that gets closer to the marrow kind of thing. That makes any sense. You know, like why two scenes in one episode revolving around Bobby and Shelley are out of the timeline.
Mm-hmm.
Why? You know, because, I mean, we can kind of, between us and the feedbackers, we're usually able to figure out pretty much everything that's going on in a given episode.
Yeah.
You know?
No, like, we try.
Well, we try.
I don't know if we're succeeding.
But we get like 75% of the way there. But, like, I am just at a loss as to, like, how either one of these scenes would be worth showing out of sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's going on? Especially if you just tweak the dialogue even minorly, you bring it up to speed, and then you just, it fits in the normal timeline. So that's all I'm saying. Certain things would make sense if you showed them out of time. There'd be a good, compelling reason for that. Scenes with Shelley and Bobby, maybe not so much. So I'm just questioning, like, if that is the case, like, where are we going with that?
Don't know. Till we get to the end, I guess.
I know.
I mean, it's curious, and I'm making note of it that there are things that don't seem right time-wise, but as far as for me to try to understand what exactly is going on, I'm at a loss, but at the same time, I'm very interested to know as to why it's there, and I'm looking forward to everything falling into place,
mm-hmm.
and I'm enjoying waiting for that to happen, but I'm not going to double down on anything.
Oh,
you know,
no,
as far
you can't.
As like what I think it is. So, because I just, this is not a show to double down on.
No, I agree completely. I mean, it's the fun of it, you know, and it's just, it's crazy I missed it. So it definitely puts that there for sure.
You don't have to double down, but you can double R.
Oh. It was a sad scene for me because we find out they're not together.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that
I know.
Unexpected.
That's disappointing.
Yeah, yeah, because I wanted to see them be like, you know, hold each other by the hip, maybe a little peck, you know, when she comes back with the food, you know. It would have been nice. I wanted to imagine them together.
Well, at first I thought they were, and then when Ed says, you know, there's nothing happening here,
mm-hmm.
go ahead and have a seat, you know, with us. You're not interrupting anything. I was like, whoa, what's up with that? And then when Walter comes in and Ed excuses himself and Walter's like, what's that guy's name again? And she has to say Ed Hurley. And I even thought that Walter might have been her husband
right.
when he first came in. So he's not, but he's apparently Double R is a franchise now. And there's five of them. And three out of the five are turning a profit. Hers is one of the two that's not. And the reasons it sounds like those ones that are turning a profit is because they're skimping on the ingredients, which he's trying to get her to do, which is goes against her grain. Not only are the recipes important, but also what you put into it. So
absolutely.
So if you've got an agreement that all of your franchises are going to use the same recipes, do everything by the book, right?
Yeah.
But then on the flip side of that agreement is they can procure the ingredients to the recipes wherever they want. So it's like, it's going to be very different if you shop like Norma does and you get natural, organic, local stuff, like she says. And mm-hmm. if you go down to the dollar store to get your bullshit to put in the pies, they're going to taste completely different. How is this going over this guy's head? That doesn't make, just because it's more profitable to be able to do it the other way. You know, he kind of reminded me of Hank Jennings in a way.
Mm.
And so that just shows you there's more patterns of bad behavior with right. women in Twin Peaks and their men. You know, she's going back towards this type of like, you know, soap opera haired shiesty guy, you know, who's all talk and whatever else. Like, why is she even dating him in the first place? What was the peck on the cheek about? And then they're going out to dinner that night. It's like, you got the love of your life sitting two booths over eating dinner with Bobby Briggs and you're dealing with this schmo. I don't know.
Yeah, well, he's more about the bottom line, which is money, profit.
Mm-hmm.
He's the reason why things turn to shit.
Yep, that's it. A lot of restaurants run into this issue.
I mean, it's not just restaurants. It's
every
all kinds
facet
of business.
Of
yeah.
And anytime you take something that you put love and care into or consider it art, and then you try to subvert or like you try to make it subservient to the market, it's going to get diluted. It's going to get crappy. It's going to get, mm-hmm. it's going to become pablum. It's not going to be what it's supposed to be anymore. Just remember how toys used to be constructed, you know, back in, I mean, I'm not that old, so we're not talking about 50s or 60s, but when we, you know, got, you remember this, Paul, when we got Transformers toys,
they were
like
awesome.
Die cast metal. These things were heavy. You know, you could throw it at somebody and do some damage.
That's
now,
true.
I've seen my nephew had some years and years ago, and they're just mostly plastic pieces of crap, but they probably get sold for the same price.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, everything just gets like, it goes down and down and down and down and down. And this guy's like an embodiment of that. He's that glad-handing, you know, big word-using guy who just kind of comes in and talks about, like M said, profitability and the bottom line, and everything else just goes out the door.
Mm-hmm. I like the way which she stood her ground about the name, you know, talking about how long it's been in Twin Peaks. It was good to see her at least stand her ground on that aspect.
But they do go out to dinner later.
Yeah.
And Ed's watching intently, and then at the end of the episode, we're going to see Ed sitting at the gas, Big Ed's gas farm, like he's waiting for her or something. Like she's not,
I don't know,
actually kind of worried about her.
Waiting. I think he was just being sad because
I got the feeling he was looking out the window waiting for somebody to pull up.
Possibly.
Like he was waiting, but not for anything specific, like just waiting for things to get better.
I played Nazareth's Love Hurts to that scene, and it played like a music video for it. It was really, really fucking sad.
Love Hurts. Did you really do that?
I found it on my phone and played it and was like, oh, that's just not good. You know, because there's the double R to-go cup, and he's just kind of sitting there eating it, watching cars drive by. It was like, and then burning stuff, like, you know.
And, you know, he tells Bobby in this same scene that we're talking about now, you know, it's no good to eat alone. And then what does he do at the end of the episode? Yeah. He eats alone. He's eating his little cup of soup or whatever it is.
Depressing.
So we have a scene where Nadine and Dr. Amp connect. He sees his shovel hanging in her shop and he screeches to a stop and he goes and rings her doorbell aggressively. And she comes out and they talk about shoveling the shit out of their lives. And the last time he saw her was 7 years ago, which she was trying to hunt for a potato that had fallen at a grocery store. But he made note how there was a really bad storm that night.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was like, oh.
And then the scene stops.
Yeah.
So you're left wondering, like, what happened during this storm? What was the importance of that?
Yeah.
And of course, with the storm comes electricity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I like this little scene because you get a glimpse of that old Nadine when she's like, can I call you Dr. Amp?
Yeah.
And she just gets amped up. You know, she's just so excited about it. And, you know, it almost seems like people can just be honest about the connections they have with each other on this show. And Dr. Amp and Nadine can get together. And then Big Ed and Norma can finally get together. I mean, it sucks that somewhere close in the neighborhood of 25 years has gone by after in the original series, they were already going on, what, 10 or 15 years of having this kind of closeted love affair. And then, or I shouldn't say closeted, like under wraps love affair, you know, where they couldn't tell anybody else about it.
Absolutely.
And it's just like, it's such a shame. So, I mean, I think that scene at the end of the episode is just really drives it home. Like that, the look on his face, Everett McGill does such a good job of conveying that loss, like as you think about all the lost time that's gone by and you haven't fulfilled the potential that you wanted to in your life, and you're just like, damn.
Yeah, is anybody in Twin Peaks okay?
Mm-mm.
No, because even Andy and them are having shopping issues online. They're together at least, but they're buying.
That can cause serious problems. They could be compulsive shoppers. They could be getting into a whole lot of debt. You know, who knows with that stuff. But seriously, though, you know, and this guy that comes in, who is Walter, he's like, I think he's kind of like the outside coming in. Yeah, he's representative of the outsider coming into Twin Peaks and trying to modernize it, trying to make it all of these things that it never wanted to be. It just wants to be this quiet little backwater town where, you know, everybody counts and everybody's worth something. And then here comes the bottom line and profitability and all that other stuff. But we were talking about Dr. Amp, a.k.a. Dr. Jacoby and Nadine. I thought it was a funny scene.
Well, I did too. I was kind of hoping they were going to hook up.
They still might. Mm-hmm. Who knows what happened after that conversation about the storm and what that meant.
Right.
So next we have a scene with Sarah Palmer with a glitchy boxing match. She's low on vodka. Was this before the vodka ran out and she went to the store? Is this after, because she was only able to buy three instead of more because she was disappointed?
Yeah.
This is a really unnerving scene. With that repeat of that boxing match drives me crazy. Actually, sounds like what I imagine it's like to be a parent raising kids with video games on all the time in the house.
Right. I mean, that's a good point. And if you look when the boxing match, it's the knockout blow every time. You know, he lands a right. and goes to the mat, and they're like, oh, now they're going over. This could be the – and you hear the electricity, and it starts over again. So it's like a knockout. She's watching the final blow of a boxing match over and over.
So we've had Dougie focus on Bushnell's boxing poster in the past. So this must have something – are we going to have a boxing match between Dougie and Mr. C?
It's possible.
I hope not, because Mr. C packs punch that a powerful in. Punch. Yeah.
Right. So.
Yeah, well, Dougie almost ripped Ike the Spike's hand off.
That's true. He's pretty strong on his own with the...
He's quick.
Yeah. I mean, it'll be interesting to see the way it pans out. And then I paused it and looked, and I couldn't tell because of the TV. I was in my studio. The TV's not as great. It looked like a bowl of macaroni and cheese. You know what I'm talking about?
In Sarah's
living room. Yeah, did you see it?
Oh, no, that was cigarette butts.
Yeah, those were cigarette butts.
She's got the two bowls. She's got the two things of cigarette butts. There's two ashtrays in front of her full, which I've seen at people's houses before. It's disgusting. But if you look to the right of her, it looks like mac and cheese or could be cream corn. It's just a plate with yellow food on it.
Ew.
Mm-hmm.
And what Ed was eating was yellowish too, but I think it was like a soup.
Yeah, because I watched the I liked the scene actually quite a bit. You know, it's another time to where, like you said, David Lynch and Frost kind of affect you with just what's going on in the background. You know, kind of like the scene with the weird teddy bear, the cracked out Teddy Ruxpin talking over and over. You know, so it's like, okay, I want to try and see if I catch anything. I saw the weird plate of food, and then it's like she even replayed a couple times, because doesn't she go to the kitchen twice to get more booze, but it's the bottom of the bottles?
Well, it makes me wonder if like somebody's going to die, because you have that glitch on there, just like the record when Maddie was killed was like...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like it was a lock groove or something.
And then we had the spotlight on Sunny Jim, which there was a spotlight on Maddie. And then we have somebody crying in the roadhouse, which Donna was crying in the roadhouse when Maddie died.
Oh, yeah.
She cried inexplicably. She didn't know why she was crying. You remember that?
I do remember that. I'm trying to remember, did all of these things happen after or before the death was revealed to us?
Spotlight was on Maddie. The record was stuck in its groove while Maddie was being killed. And then after she was killed, after we knew it, when they flashed to the, or maybe it was like interspersed, I can't remember exactly, but they flashed to the roadhouse, and that's when Cooper and the log lady are sitting at the roadhouse, and Julie Cruz is singing, and they know something terrible is happening. It's happening again. Donna is sitting across from James at the roadhouse, and she starts crying, and she can't explain why.
So you have all of this stuff kind of coming back, so you're thinking this is foreshadowing somebody's death coming up.
Yeah. I mean, it would make sense. Somebody's got to get it.
I think a lot of somebodies are going to get it coming up soon.
Yeah, but this would imply somebody we care about.
I do like the way that David Lynch uses the sound design for this kind of effect, the repetition, because like Paul had mentioned, you had the hello Johnny, how are you today, the creepy bear, then you had the honking horn from a couple of episodes ago that just kept going and going and going, then you have the got a light, and you got, you know, a bunch of other obvious examples that I'm probably missing of that kind of sound repetition that keeps going almost like if it's on this endless loop. And it unnerves you. It just gets you into that state of mind to whatever Lynch is going to deliver hits you that much harder, like the boxers on the screen, because you're just – everything's heightened. So, you know, like, you know when you're, like, already scared and somebody comes up behind you and just, like, gooses you or something, and you jump up and, like, hit your head in the ceiling because it's just how it is. But that's the mental state that he's getting you into. So it does feel like a precursor to something like that. Like, what are they getting us ready for?
And as far as like the repetition, this one like unnerved me more than Johnny and the cracked Teddy Ruxpin and the honking horn.
The other ones you could kind of easily ascertain where it was coming from and why it was happening. But this one, it's like, okay, is she watching this on a DVD that's glitching out and skipping at a certain point and then going back 30 seconds or 10 seconds or however long it is, because it can't be on the regular TV because the broadcast would keep going. So even if you lost power and it glitched out like that, it's not going to jump back and then keep playing the same segment.
Well, I mean, does that happen?
No, I don't think it can, because the broadcast signal keeps going on with the new material.
But considering the house and things that are kind of going on, obviously, you know, something strange is afoot at the Circle K. You know, it's...
Yeah.
it's definitely, you know, whatever or whoever is in there with her is just affecting everything, you know. So even if it was a broadcast, if they can affect electricity the way they do and you hear it, you know, it's kind of like their calling card. You definitely know something or somebody's in the house with her, and it's just them affecting it. You know, it's like their calling card.
Wow. I would just pull the plug on that goddamn television, though. Oh, I wouldn't have been able to.
I would have moved out of the house that. Years ago. Yeah, yeah. Fuck that.
So next we have Audrey and Charlie. So typically we don't have follow-ups so much, but we were lucky to get it with Audrey 2 episodes back-to-back with her. But now it's a completely different feeling coming from Audrey, where she was fighting to gain control of a situation, and now she seems out of control and lost. Mm-hmm. She's saying that she does not feel like herself, like she feels like she's someone else. She's not sure who she is, but she's definitely not her. She can't remember how to get to the roadhouse all of a sudden.
Yeah. I have a theory on this. So she was in the explosion. She was in a coma. We know that for sure, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if she died for a little bit before she went into a coma and has a little bit of brain damage, and this is her doctor that she's dealing with? She's in because her brother is messed up and has issues, so why not? And it's sad because I don't want to think of Audrey this way, but maybe Audrey is suffering kind of something similar, and because the way he talks to her makes me feel like he's her doctor. Like, you want me in this story? I can give you some Thorazine, and then we're just going to start all over again, and we're going to see how you're affected tomorrow. Because he just seems like a psychiatrist or a doctor for some reason to me in this scene.
That's an interesting take on that statement, because I was definitely curious about what he meant by ending this story.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that she's not in a coma at this point. She's alive. Alive. I mean, people in comas are alive. I understand that. But like she's conscious and all of this stuff is going on in her head. And this guy's not her husband. He's her doctor. But part of the therapy is to play out these fantasies that she has in her head to try to make a breakthrough.
Well, not just breakthrough, but, you know, it happens sometimes to where people are so worked up that it's like calling a crazy person crazy. It sets them off. So if you kind of let them play it out and come to, like you said, a breakthrough, come to the realization that something's wrong with me because I don't know if I want to leave. I don't know if I want to go. Tell me what to do, because she's having this panic attack, essentially. She's breaking down to where it's like, well, do you want to go or do you not? Because he's sitting there very calm and handling this in a really normal, like, even in the scene before, he handles it very well. And he knows by telling her the information about her son that she's going to completely fall apart and go into this manic state, you know? So it felt very, and we don't know where they're at. That could be part of, their house somewhere, just a section, like a wing that she's in with this doctor that's there. That's why there'd be like a contract, or you came to me, or, you know, the paperwork that he needs to sign might be paperwork for her to be able to leave on her own. It's not a divorce papers. It could be papers, commitment papers, you know, like you've been committed. You know, the only way you can sign yourself out is if you sign it.
So there's no Billy and there's no Tina and there's no none of these people. It's
he
just
called Tina.
Well, you think he called. We don't know for sure. He talked to a Tina. That could have been her dad.
Why did he fuck with her, acting like he got some sort of information and not tell her? Well, how does that help her?
He's not really fucking with her. He just doesn't know how to handle to tell her your son killed somebody because
Tina doesn't exist and he's not getting that information.
And yeah, but he might
Tina.
Not have been calling Tina. He might have been calling her dad, saying, look, this is going on. You know, and her dad knew because 2 scenes before, her dad had gotten the information. So maybe he's talking to her dad and saying, yeah, I'm talking to Tina, you know, because her dad knows the state she's in, gives him the information like, look, this is going on the outside. Don't let her leave. Don't let her go to the roadhouse right now, because people know that her son killed somebody and beat up his grandma, you know? So that's why he's like, I don't know if I can tell you.
Everything that we've seen between these two characters has happened inside of a room. It's not the same room necessarily, unless this is just an expanded view of that room, like the other side of it that was behind Audrey, you know, and off to her left in the back, I guess. But from the previous episode, but the way that he talks to her, like the statement you guys were talking about, like, do I need to end this story or do you want me to write the end? Well, I forgot exactly what it is that he said. But
or textbook existentialism, all that, you know, it's very. I had to look it up. I didn't know what it was.
Like he's her shrink or something.
Yeah,
that's her doctor. That makes sense. Exactly, to me. Her doctor, and then the whole thing about being the lawfully wedded husband? Do you think that's just like role playing from the last part?
I mean, role play or just trying to keep her calm without having to medicate her.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, there's different ways you could treat somebody like that. One way is to tie him up and put a weird teddy bear in front of him.
So maybe role playing is the only way he can get results from her. If he acts like her therapist, it freaks her out probably.
Because if she is in a state, the last thing she needs to hear is what her son did, which would also mean... Because why wouldn't her dad not bring her up whenever he's talking to the sheriff? You know, like, oh, I need to call Audrey and let her know what's going on with her son.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he knows it. If this is the case, if we follow this through, then he knows that she's in no state to be able to hear that kind of information.
It'll set her off. I know, it's kind of weird. It just felt like that. So then I started thinking about it, and I was like, well, this fits, and this kind of fits. It's probably totally wrong. I'm probably just going crazy, but it just felt that way. Whenever he started, you know, telling her, well, this is textbook. You know, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it right. I can't say it.
Existentialism.
Yes, thank you. It also felt like she was in the coma still, possibly also. Like, she's like, it doesn't feel like me and all that, you know, but it's almost too obvious.
And she says it feels like Ghostwood, which is a really weird statement.
Yeah, it is. And that's the first time that we've heard in 13 hours of Twin Peaks that we've heard of Ghostwood being brought up.
Or she said it's like Ghostwood here. Huh.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can dig it. I can dig that theory because that makes a lot of sense because there was a lot of interesting theories about her being in trapped in some sort of hell, and that's why she wasn't able to move last episode. Mm-hmm. But the first thing she does in this episode is move from one place to another to go to sit down on a chair. So I can dig that because it makes a lot more sense than her being married to him.
Mm-hmm.
Because that one was just sticking in my craw because I'm like, why would this be... I just don't get it. But anyway, did you guys, I'm sure everybody noticed the decor in that room, how the room was set up. It looked like it was from the 50s or 60s. Yes. I can't really tell.
It's just paperwork and shit everywhere.
Like yeah, it was in disarray, but it had the decor in there had not been updated for generations. Not just decades, generations.
Generations, right? I don't know.
Well, let's see if we get a follow-up on the next episode.
Hopefully.
Well, I think we've got feedback on this, so we'll be talking about it on...
Fantastic.
And, you know, she could have a little bit of agoraphobia going on, too. That's why she's never actually going to leave the house, even though she threatens to leave.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's part of his job to make it seem rational that she doesn't want to leave. So when she's coming to that middle ground of like, well, what is it? What do you want to do? And she's like, well, I want to do both. I want to leave and I want to stay here. So he's kind of pulling her back to the stay here mode of thinking slowly but surely.
If that's like therapy for somebody who has agoraphobia, it seems like you would want to combat that and get them to want to like...
Want to leave. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's Twin Peaks therapy. You don't know what the hell's going on, you know?
Yeah, but there's a time for that. I don't know this. I'm talking like I know this, but it would seem like that there would be an optimal time to put someone in that kind of immersive therapy where they say, okay, you're agoraphobic, so we're making you go outside, but not when they're already in that agitated state.
Yeah, when they're not
manic. You want to do it. Yeah, you want to bring them out to the backyard on a nice day and then maybe take a stroll when no one else is around, and you don't want to just drive them to the roadhouse.
Yeah.
Because of the loud music and people crying and all that stuff.
Yeah, baby steps.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Roadhouse is proud to present James Hurley. I think it's funny that we've got the Roadhouse actually introducing James Hurley, saying they're proud to present, because I think David Lynch knows quite well how there's a pretty good chunk of Twin Peaks fandom that hates this song.
Yes, because it's kind of ridiculous.
It's a horrible song. It's always been a horrible song. It's always going to be a horrible song. You can put James Hurley on the stage, you know, with some teenage girls singing with him at the Roadhouse and nice lighting, and the song is still bad. So.
Yes.
I wish they had actually had him sing it, like a new version of it, or sing it live. He wouldn't have been able to hit those notes, I'm sure. I know he struggled with those notes at that time when they recorded that the first time. He doesn't have to hit those notes. he can have just a different rendition of it.
Yeah, have somebody else sing it. Well, why did that girl start crying, though? Is it some kind of mojo he's got?
Oh, the song was just so bad. She was brought to tears.
Well, no, I think, you know, I brought up how Donna cried at the Roadhouse. So I think it's a callback to that, which was a different scenario that invoked the crying to begin with. She didn't know why she was crying. I also think this is, we don't see who's sitting with her at the booth. The first time we actually were introduced to this character, her name's Renee, was at the end of episode 2 when we first see James, and Shelley thinks that he's looking at her friend Renee, but I thought maybe it's possible that James is actually looking at Shelley. You can't really quite tell. And I wasn't really convinced that James was looking at Renee here. I think Renee just thinks he is. And maybe he's really looking at the person who's sitting across from her, and we don't know who it is.
Shelley wasn't at the diner earlier.
Yes, exactly. That's how it happened the first time he played Just You and I. Donna thinks he's looking at her, and then she realizes he's looking at Maddie, and she gets super, super jealous.
And so Donna being a brunette and Maddie being a brunette, and then you have two high schoolish aged girls who are both brunettes singing backup, kind of like as a callback. They don't try to make them look like either of those two really necessarily, but
yeah,
it makes it, that's what I thought of immediately. Like, that's the backup singers again, you know. But the crying is a cool callback to that. But there's definitely somebody sitting at the table with her.
Yeah, because she talks to her.
You can see her. Yeah, she's like, or at least gesturing to her with the wine, and you know.
Mm-hmm. So we'll see. We don't really have much time for relationship drama to play out, but we'll
what
see.
Else does his character do, though? I mean, come on, that's all that guy ever did.
Well, he in the Entertainment Weekly, there was a little blurb from him where he claimed that his role was small but extremely significant.
People still hate me. That's the whole point. We'll see. I mean, there's plenty of time left.
So after this scene, we're back with Ed at his gas station. He's eating alone, as he advised Bobby against doing. And it's sad. And this is not how we wanted to see Ed. Mm-mm. But this is what we're given, just like we didn't want to see Audrey that way, and that's what we've been given. Everybody is with the exception of Nadine, I think.
Yeah.
Nadine's doing pretty well. Yeah. But she is working late, though, you know? It's like she doesn't have anything else besides that. So her life, to me, would be out of balance. If all you have is just work, that's even if it's work you're passionate about, and you got to have something else to leaven it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
It seems like she runs, so this is her drape shop, and she probably works there, you know, 6-7 days a week. And then Dr. Amp comes on at 7 o'clock every night. So she probably closes up the shop sometime around 6, and then she has her sippy cup and she watches Dr. Amp. Then she goes home, and then Big Ed stays at the gas barn for, you know, after the double R, after his shift, you know, he goes back to his job. And so it's like they're just kind of avoiding each other. They're probably living like roommates.
You think they're still together?
He's wearing a ring.
Is he? I'm gonna miss that too.
She's still listed as Nadine Hurley.
Oh wow.
So I know we've always talked about how when people get divorced, they generally just keep the last name that they had.
Yeah.
You know, they don't always bother to go back to their maiden name or whatever other name they want to change it to. So that's one thing. But he does have a ring, and he's obviously not married to Norma. So unless there's even more drama to where he got married to somebody else in the meanwhile, I'm assuming that they are. But yeah, that'd be a dreary life. Just like, yeah, I'm going to work every day, and then I'm going to hang out in the back room and watch Dr. Amp on the computer. Then I'm going to go home, go to bed, and start the whole process over again.
We'll meet up around 10, go to bed, and then get up. Go to our separate spaces.
But she could be in the process of changing her life in some sort of positive fashion, because she tells Dr. Amp that she is shoveling herself out of the shit. So maybe that's, you know, maybe he's, their bad marriage is one of the things that she needs to get out from under. But I'm sure all she ever had to do was ask, you know.
All right. Well, that's it for our coverage of part 13. Once again, our deadline for feedback for part 13 is Thursday, 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. We're already getting quite a bit of feedback. Everybody's keeping to the 2-3 paragraph request. It looks like we're going to have a lot of feedback, so we want to stress that again so we can make sure we get everybody in and not have to edit your emails.
All right, so we'll see you in a couple of days when we read your feedback, and thank you for joining us for our coverage of part 13. Part 14 will be here before you know it. This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
Together forever in love.